Good morning. We are in Jackson, Michigan, to the annual convention of Ecclesia here. This is September 6, 1976, a beautiful morning as we've had the previous two mornings, rejoicing in the truth with those of like precious faith. We have persuaded Brother Colliman to be subjected to an interview in which we'll try to explore his memory. He has quite a storehouse of fine thoughts on those past years. And to help Brother Peter search out those gems, we've asked Brother George Eldridge of the Jackson Group to be our moderator. So, Brother George, Brother Peter is yours.
Thank you. Brother Peter, the purpose of the interview this morning, as I understand, is to interview you of your past experiences in the church. But before we do, Peter, I'm sure you'll agree with me, we'll open with a little prayer to the Lord to guide our minds and hearts in recapturing some of these thoughts. Dear Father in heaven, we thank thee for privilege of being here in convention in this holy place with those of like precious faith. And we ask now that you would open our minds and hearts, Brother Peter's and mind, and those of the listeners, that we might sing forth thy praises in the way that thou hast dealt with Brother Peter in his life. Guide my lips that I might be able to bring these thoughts to the surface, that he might share his experiences with all of the saints. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Brother Peter, first of all, I'd like to ask you a question. When did you, where were you born? And tell us a little bit about your parents, if you would, and your nationality and so forth.
I was born on an island in the Aegean Sea. At the time of my birth, it was under the jurisdiction of Turkey, although I was born from Greek parents. In fact, all the citizens of the village were Greek Orthodox Catholic persuasion. Our family was very, very poor family. My father was a shoemaker, and he had to travel to other parts of the world to earn a living for the family. It just turned out that every time he came home, he had another baby.
So, how many children were in the family?
Well, there were seven of us that survived. Probably there were 10, maybe a dozen conceptions altogether.
It's an interesting number seven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seven survived, five girls and two boys. I was the oldest of the family. And we had some customs at that time that meant that the father and the boys, especially the oldest boy, would have to earn some money to build homes before the daughters could get married. So father had to travel to Constantinople and work there, to Smyrna and work there, to Alexandria in Egypt, to Athens, and twice to the United States. And
Brother Peter, let me just interject something here. Do you have brothers or sisters still living in Greece?
Yes, there are four sisters and my brother still living on the island of Mytilene.
Are they in the truth as we know it?
I sent a set of studies in the scriptures, in the Greek, to my brother. He didn't pay any attention to it until the Second World War started. And then he was in the army, the Greek army, and he was stationed in Epirus when the Italians invaded that part of Greece. The Greek armies were defeated, and they withdrew, and in retiring, he came to Athens. And then he remembered the stories and the scriptures and sought some friends in Athens.
Ah.
But at the time, the people that he got in touch with were Jehovah's Witnesses, and so he is of that affiliation as of now.
I see.
They have very little in common.
I see. Let me ask you this, Brother Peter. When did you leave Greece to come to this country to live?
I left Greece in May 1911. I got to New York in June 1911. My father was living then in Reading, Pennsylvania, and we went to Reading.
I see.
Now, we lived in Reading.
I see. Now, the next question, Brother Peter, I think that would be of interest to the brethren is, how did you first hear the truth, you know, when, where, and the circumstances, briefly?
Well, you say briefly, and that's that damaging. But in Reading, Pennsylvania, there was a very active group of Bible students, and we used to get tracts at our doors very near every month. I remember the tracts, but I didn't pay too much attention to them. But one day, in November, with a little snow on the ground, there was a strike in a steel mill just on the outskirts of Reading, and there were quite a number of Greeks working in the steel mill where the strike was taking place. So I was walking out 6th Street in Reading to go to the picket line, not to have a part in it, but for some reason or other, to see some men that I knew and probably greet them, encourage them, and whatever. It was on the way to, but while I was on this mission, that I noticed a newspaper at the door of every home as we passed it. And I thought, well, now that's strange. They couldn't all be buying the same paper. So I stopped and picked one up to see what it was all about. And the heading, it was the Pittsburgh Labor Gazette. And the heading was, "The World Has Ended. Millions now living will never die," says Judge Rutherford as he goes to prison. Now, the way it turned out, Brother Hudgens, who was working at the Bible House, and who was left almost in charge when the brethren were put in jail, in prison, that he contracted with the Labor Gazette to let him use the whole issue, four full newspaper pages, as a tract.
I say now.
And that was the tract that was being distributed.
Brought you into the church.
I picked it up.
Now, what year was that then?
That was must have been 1918.
I see. So then you've really been associated with the truth now since 1918. Did you know Brother Russell at all, or you hadn't met him?
I knew of Brother Russell because there was another man that came from the same village that was a Bible student living in Reading. I knew him, and I remember meeting him on the street and telling him that I read in the paper that his pastor had died. I wasn't in the truth then.
I see.
But that registered, and he was almost beside himself. He was shocked to hear that Pastor Russell was dead. That was 1916, 2 years earlier, yeah. Right, this happened.
Well, let me ask you this, Brother Peter. From my recollection, and you know, you and I remember when I first came into truth, the great help that I've gotten just, you know, coming to your conventions and having you come to our ecclesia and give talks and so forth, and it's been a great blessing to me. And I remember that you told me that you were involved with the Frank and Ernest program, that you had something to do with the, setting up of the equipment and operating it or something with... could you tell us a little about that and what brethren were involved with it?
Well, there's quite a period of time between the two.
I see. You mean From 1918 to when you got involved in the Frank and Ernest thing.
It would be from 1918 to about 1931-32. And all that period of time was full of experiences for me.
And who were the two brethren that were the Frank and Ernest during your...
At the time when Brother Woodruff, of course, was... I don't know what to call him. I don't want to call him bad names.
Well, no, but we don't want to do that.
We eliminate that, yes. We don't want to make any aspersions to anybody's character or standing. He was the head of the Dawn.
Yes.
And it was he who was an elder previously in Wilmington before he went to work for the White Star the second time for him. He quit the White Star and started the Dawn, and we had a part in that. And some of the friends, young friends that were working at the Dawn, were joining the conscientious objectors camps, and they needed help. So he came to me and asked me to. I'm jumping my story. I'm evading your story, and I don't want to evade it.
No.
Brother Wilson and he came down to the house. I was an electrician. Additionally, I was very much interested in radio, and in fact, my wife and I ran a little radio store for a while, and she knew all that. So he came to us and asked us to let us build an amplifier. They brought down a recorder, a record recorder, and another playback machine. And I was to make the amplifier, so I built the amplifier, and we made the recordings in our attic. We finished our attic so it'd be acoustically acceptable. And we made the recordings up in our attic from then on. We continued that for about 10 years. And my wife, Sister Mirza, used to play the record that we made, which we called it the master,
yes.
And then copy it probably 20, sometimes 30 times, and send it all over the country to different radio stations that were carrying the program at the time. That's how we started the Frank and Ernest program.
Well, that's very interesting, Brother Peter. And I also, for the sake of the brethren who will listen to this tape, if you could, tell us a little bit of, did you do anything at all in the photodrama during your time in the truth? You have done something about preparation of slides, haven't you? Copying them or something?
Well, after we, about the photodrama, after we left the service of the Dawn, went back to Wilmington, we started to work on the photodrama, copying the slides that were a large slide, probably 3 by 4 inches, and reduced them to 35 millimeter slides. I made the equipment for that. We bought a camera, and it wasn't acceptable. We discarded that. We bought another camera. And so far, we made probably 50 to 60 sets of 450 slides each.
Are they still in circulation?
They're all out among the friends.
That's beautiful.
I only have one copy. A Greek brother who had almost a complete set of the original photogramma slides, died, and Brother Fry inherited it, and he was kind enough to give it to me. I still have the set.
I have a question here, if I may interject, concerning the slides. Was there a script or written materials that would describe each slide?
Only the titles, and not all of them. Not all of the slides had titles. but the title, but presented with the only descriptive information that we could get. We have a list of them. And with every set that we make, we supply a list.
As they were presented in the theater to a group, would there be a moderator or a narrator?
Well, that's independent. Whatever the friends do with them, I don't know. The only one that I know is a Brother Brown at Columbus, Indiana. He uses the slides, selective slides. He don't use all the slides, but he uses them in fraternal orders and business circles and all kinds of things.
By the way, brethren who are listening to this tape, I might interject here that was Brother Malinowski, the third voice. I'm not throwing my voice, you know, or changing it. For Brother Peter, I think what we would all be interested in, and I know I have in the years that I've known you, in the names of some of your brethren, the early soldiers of the cross. Could you just give us like a little resume of some of the ones that you enjoyed their fellowship and their company, and maybe an anecdote or two, and whether they're still among us, and if so, where are they living? You know, some of the older brethren. That's what we're interested in.
Well, the old timers practically are all gone. We hope now with the Lord. But the people that I remember was Brother Van Amberg, who was Secretary Treasurer of the Watchtower. He married Mary Jane Massal. Very, very wonderful brother, and very much obligated to him for his kindness and love for us. And yet, about, I would say, 1927, 28, he was having a funeral in near Wilmington, and he had the funeral. And on the way to the funeral, I was driving the car, and he was sitting next to me. And I asked him, I said, Brother Van Amberg, what are the chances of getting rid of Judge Rutherford? And he looked at me askance. He says, Peter, not a ghost of a chance. He and I hold most of the proxies.
That's beautiful. See, now we would never know a story like that if.
And then, of course, there are others.
Give us a couple of more, Brother Peter. These you've told now, Brother Van Amberg is dead, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And give us a couple of more.
Brother Hudgens was another wonderful man. Originally, when he worked under Brother Russell, they called him the boy preacher. He was a redhead. After we left the society, we found out that he had left it too. And after leaving it, he went to school. He became a lawyer. He learned to write. Went to school to learn good methods of writing. And he got interested in Israel. He got to be friendly with a man named Gordon, who was one of the original Jewish settlers in Palestine. Gordon was interested especially in colonizing and working the land. Mm. He believed and taught that the land to become Jewish must be worked by Jewish hands, that they couldn't go there and hire Arabs to do the work. They had to do it themselves.
And do you feel that some of his ancestors might still be there and some of his
Gordons?
Yeah.
Probably. But at least he had Gordon write the introduction to Zionism and Prophecy that Brother Hudgens wrote.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And then, additionally, he wrote another pamphlet that both the prophecy, the Zionist booklet, and the one that I'm going to describe, Evolutionists at the Crossroads. They were beautiful pieces, and I personally believe They are the best pieces of literature in on the truth.
Could you repeat those two pieces of literature again, so we'd have it on the tape?
Zionism and prophecy, and evolutionists at the crossroads. The Don, after he wrote and the Don published the two books, and after Brother Woodworth, who always gave credit to him, that he taught him methods of writing, they quarreled for some reason or other. And the books were discontinued, and Brother Hudgens was withdrew from the Don and died in a bitter man.
Oh, that's too bad.
I'm sorry to say.
Yes.
There are others the same way. I remember Brother Kubler, who was educated a Catholic priest. He finished his education in Rome. And then somehow or other, he came across the divine plan of the ages and accepted the truth. He left the society at the time that we did, and he worked at the Dawn until he passed away. His wife, Sister Hoover, worked at the Dawn, in her old age, lived near enough, and she passed away. Those are some of the friends that I had in the truth movement.
Well, thank you for that, Brother Peter. Now, earlier you mentioned that you had told this friend of yours in Reading about Brother Russell's death when you saw it in that, I think you saw it in the newspaper.
Yeah.
And you said it had quite an effect on him. Can you elaborate on just what effect Brother Russell's death did have on the brethren that you knew, you know, from that after you came into the truth? It must have had quite an effect on him, didn't it?
That is out of my line because I wasn't in the truth at the time.
Oh.
And I didn't know just how they took it.
Can I rephrase that question, Brother Peter? What after effects was noted in the truth movement after Brother Russell's death, say after you came in the truth in 1918? I know that you went through quite the severe experiences in your history in the Jehovah Witness and after you came out and so forth.
Well, when we started to go to the meeting, the first meeting that I attended was Sunday, a weekend visit by a brother that worked at what he called the Bible House, a brother Zook. The first talk that he gave in the morning talks, when they traveled, they usually gave two talks each Sunday. The first talk was to the friends. In the afternoon talk, the 3 o'clock talk was always a public talk. Brother Zook spoke about the love of God, and that captured me. That captured me in the truth. I never heard anything like it. I never heard God described in terms that Brother Zook used that day.
Yeah.
By the way, I never saw Brother Zook since.
Hmm.
I don't know whatever became of him.
But he did make quite an impression in their life.
No question about that. No question about that. But that's the way the friends... And then we had tracts. Judge Rutherford has published The Finished Mystery, and I remember canvassing with The Finished Mystery. But then he repudiated it later on and introduced other books on Revelation, his own, and I think he repudiated them since. I don't know what they're believing now. But that was our experiences in the Watchtower. My first real acquaintance with the Watchtower was I was working in a steel mill as an electrician. And it was July or August, probably August. And I had a job to do, and I finished the job. And my foreman was surprised that I got done so quickly. And he gave me another man and a ladder and a bucket of water and a sponge to go through this mill and clean the light reflectors.
Yeah.
Underneath were rolling mills. White hot steel, and the sun from above, and we were. I never perspired so much in my life. That night, it was a Wednesday, I went to meet him, and they read a letter from the Watchtower inviting the volunteers to go to work at the office. So, this brother that I told about the death of Brother Russell, he and I offered ourselves to go to Brooklyn and work there for the length of time they needed us. It didn't last very long. We worked at issuing the what we called then the number 27 Golden Age. There were 4.5 million copies of that magazine, 32 pages that were printed, and distributed freely over the country. There are some bad things, I don't know that you wanted me to tell them, but...
No, you know, Brother Peter, I'll tell you now. Yeah. Okay. We're talking about Brother Russell and some of the older brethren who have passed to their reward beyond the veil. And, you know, the younger brethren today, they think of Brother Russell as the person in the world would think of Abraham Lincoln. But they also think of you, Brother Peter. They think of you as like Mr. Cole Porter, you know? You have this ability. Now, you told me, and I'm sure you're going to check me up if my memory isn't right. You told me one time about your experiences of riding a bicycle all over the state of Delaware. I wish you'd give us a little background on that.
Well, that was in 1923 when I took a leave of absence from my work, and they sent me to work to canvas to Cole Porter in Cecil County, Maryland. Cecil County is next to Newcastle County, and Wilmington is part of Cecil County, so it was the next county to us. They sent me another boy to another brother from Rochester, New York.
Remember his name?
Gilman. Uh-huh. His name was Gilman. He came out of a bank. He was a teller in a bank. And we had a set of studies in the scriptures, a harp of God, and some tracts in a little bag, and we carried the bag. He worked with me 2 days. He developed blisters in his hands in 2 days, and he quit. He went back home. And then I bought myself a bicycle. And while I worked in Cecil County, I stayed with a brother and sister Ledley. Brother Ledley was a telegrapher in the B&O Railroad, and he had a home next door to the track. To the B&O track. So he had an old Maxwell car. And I think that's all right. And he used to tie my bicycle to the car and drive out the county and drop me off. And then I would work myself back to the house each night and canvas every farmhouse on the way.
How many miles had been, Bob?
Oh,
I in one day.
I have no idea how long, how far, how many miles I covered with a bicycle.
And how long did you do this?
All summer and fall. Spring, summer, and fall of 1923.
I know I'm testing your memory to almost to completion, Brother Peter, but do you remember maybe how many volumes you might have placed?
No, I never counted volumes. I was more interested in convincing a person than selling them books.
That's beautiful. I understand.
That was my method. I know there were brethren that advertised or said how many thousands of books they sold and what sly methods they used to sell the books.
Yes.
I never felt for that. I thought that my mission was to convince the person of the truthfulness of the truth.
Well, that helps, Brother Peter, and I know that I myself, since my consecration, I've received a lot of advice and instruction from you, in not only in witnessing and co-portering, but in many facets of my Christian life. And I'm sure that this is so with other brethren, because of your testimonies at the conventions and because of your example in this co-portering. Now, what we'd like to know that's of interest to us is Well, I'm sure you can tell us what Brother Russell's favorite hymn was. I know I can't think of the number of it, but maybe you can.
I think if I, in thy likeness, O Lord, may obey, that was Brother Russell's favorite.
I see.
How'd that go again?
If I, in thy likeness, O Lord, may obey.
Yeah, we'll have to pin that one down at the actual number of it. Now, your favorite hymn, Brother Peter.
To the work, O ye servants of God.
Yeah, I figured that. That fits right in with your philosophy, your truth, your zeal for the truth, Brother Peter, is always increasing, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sure the other brethren would agree. Let me ask you something. What is your favorite type of discourse or delivery, say at a convention or at an ecclesia? What do you think is the most effective method to teach the younger brethren? You know, do you think a discourse is always effective, or a study? Which would you prefer? Give us some of your reasons.
I love a study, and I attended the meetings. Every meeting I could possibly attend, I would attend a part of study. Discourses are very necessary, but they have their place. In fact, in Wilmington, we just recently adopted a schedule of having our local elder give one talk, that is, each one, but one talk to the class a month. And then we have a visiting speaker the first Sunday is a local brother. The second Sunday is a visiting brother. All else are studies.
Yes, I think that most of us would agree with you, Brother Peter. I find that I get myself more understanding of God's plan and of the deeper things of the truth by a study of the Bible, supported, of course, by topically by the way the pastor teaches us to study. That's what I was getting at. Could you give us a comparison of today's conventions and meetings as they might have been when you started in the truth in 1918? I mean, do you think there are more people, brethren, attending the conventions, and more food used up, and, you know, whether we take advantage of the electronic devices and so forth? How does it compare with when you first came into the truth?
Of course, we didn't have anything electronic at the time.
You had to learn to talk loud, right?
Yes, you have to talk pretty loud. And I think, I don't know who to compare. My favorite talk would be along the line of Kenneth Rawson's. A little emotion in it, and a little emphasis on what you're saying. Brother Gene Burns is similar. To me,
How do they compare with Brother Zano?
Zano is a comparable. Zano was a
class by himself.
All class by himself, yes. And I think Brother Zano has done more for the truth movement in my time than any other single individual. Any other single individual.
Well, that's fine, Brother Peter. That's a wonderful memorial in our minds and hearts about Brother Zano. You know, I'm just a young brother in the truth, and I remember one day I was sitting listening to a tape of Brother Zano, and Sister Ruth caught me laughing, and she said, "That tape couldn't be funny." And I said, "Well, it is. It's Brother Zano."
Yeah.
And he had a humor that was also, I call it, like a spiritual humor.
Yeah.
It covered the point very...
Although he wasn't an educated man, yet the Spirit of the Lord was in him, and the Lord guided him and used him. And although he suffered, he wasn't allowed to do what was in his heart to do, still, it wasn't his fault. It wasn't his fault. Years after he retired altogether, one of the last things that I remember was I stopped to see him while he was sick in somewhere in Ohio. Forget now, not Akron. Kent, Ohio. Somewhere in northeastern Ohio. But anyhow, when he found out that we had organized a corporate fund and we're collecting money in order to help brethren and sisters who would enter the corporate work to provide for them, he sent me a check for $100 and told me that was the most important line of work in the truth movement, the work that was next to his heart, and please don't tell anybody about it. That Brother Zano is gone, and now I feel free to say it.
Yes.
So all of these are good expirations.
Brother Peter, the interview that we're having here, you know, purely informal between you and me, we're brethren in the Lord, and informal with the brethren that are listening to this tape. But we want it also to be very educational to the younger brethren. And so along these lines, I would ask you to just talk forth to them, if you would, some words of encouragement to these younger brethren. We saw three here at Jackson today. Publicly acknowledged to the brethren something that they had done with the Lord sometime before, and those who are trying to make up their minds to consecration, whether you urge consecration, and after that, what they should do with their lives, in the narrow way, and so forth. Remarks along this line for their encouragement, Brother Peter.
Well, when I was coming in the truth, and coming out of the darkness, the darkest section of Christianity, the Greek Orthodox Catholic Church, the truth was so superb that there was nothing in the world to compare it with. And of course, it affected our lives accordingly. I remember one time in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I gave a talk. And when I came off the stage, the sister said, one sister came to me and said, "Brother Coleman, what makes you foreigners so enthusiastic about the truth?" And my retort was, "Well, sister, perhaps it's because the Lord did so much more for us foreigners than for you."
That's beautiful.
That's the way it affected us. But it wasn't only the foreigners. It was generally the practice. When we came to the Lord in consecration, the friends asked, the individual asked, "Lord, what can I do?" And there were, at one time, there were over 300 colportes in this country. There were over 100 pilgrims going from one place to another every day, two talks every day. There were 300 or 400 people working at the Bible House. We haven't got anything like that today.
No.
That's my lament. That's why I look at our young brethren and, oh, how much work they could do. But nobody seems to think about it. Except a few, we have a few who devote some of their time to colporting. Can I name the names?
Yes.
There was Marilee Wessel. There was Alice Condell. There was Becky from Chicago. The daughter of
Becky Beard.
No. Becky.
Well, somebody will remember who she was. But how about Joyce Sarasi and Ruth Katerba?
Presently, Joyce Sarasi, Ruth Katerba, George Dohane, Paul Lango, and there were others. There are others that I can't remember it them all. But sooner or later, they either tired. I can't tell a man or a girl or a boy that will go for drink that would be a pleasant job.
No.
It is. It's a hard job. It's a hard job. Sometimes you have doors slammed in your face. Sometimes they get into arguments you can't defend yourself. You have to take it or like it.
Well, do you think, Brother Peter, then, that these young people might be discouraged by this
the
confrontation and the experience?
Yeah.
What would be your advice in a situation of that sort?
My advice see, my advice is of no value, very little value, because probably I'm the only one left. There's Brother First and Grandpappas. There are others, but they're all gone now. The friends that had the experiences that I'm related, very few of them left. And there is, and actually, there's been very little effort to tell the young friends of their experiences in order to inspire them to activity.
Yes.
So we just simply go to meetings, and there's nothing wrong with going to meetings. Mm. But knowledge is only useful if it's put to practice.
Well, Brother Peter, I understand that there are tens of thousands of tracts a year put out by the brethren. You encourage the tracting, but what you're interested in mainly is getting these volumes in the hands of the people.
My advice to the classes would be that each class of any size should have two co-porters.
I see.
How they're going to support them, that's their business. I can't tell. The co-porter fund will help.
You know, I might interject here. Maybe the Divine Plan, you know, we got a little money in the Divine Plan Foundation, and I'm on the membership. We're looking for places to spend the money that the brethren have put in the Lord's service. Maybe we can use some along these lines. You think that would be...
We have no... I'd like to be like Bel... What is his name? Bezalel?
Yes,
who told Moses, don't bring me any more.
Yeah.
I have enough. That was a wonderful thing to say.
Yeah.
And we, that run the corporate fund, did say that. And we are saying it now. We have enough money in the bank. There are no corporates to use it. So there's no use using more or carrying more money. Whatever money you have, use it where you can in the avenues and the areas where you can.
Well, Brother Peter, on this business you say about young people, now you've piqued my interest, and I'm sure some of the young people who will listen to this tape. Now, when you say, do you think that these brethren, say before they maybe take a summer or fall before they go to college or before they go to work, and put it in full-time co-porter service?
Now listen, Brother George, you are making it too easy. Take our young man who has to serve 2 years in conscientious objectors work. You give 2 years to your country for nothing. Why can't you give it to the world? What effect, what does your consecration mean to you? Unless you sacrifice something. We talk about the tabernacle. We talk about the killing of the goat. How much blood have you shed? How much blood did these young people shed for the Lord? How much shoe leather did they wear off? They put out tracks, yes. But to put out tracks in a territory is good, beautiful. To follow that by co-porters is better. To call back on the people that bought the books and stir up their interest is still better. To organize a meeting in the territory and have an elder give a chart talk or 3 chart talks, that's it. Then eventually you have a class organized.
Brother Peter, you make me ashamed because you said, how much blood have I shed? Well, when I think of my Lord, the only one, I guess, that we can say that's really been blooded, I've done some tracking and some colporting, but after what you just said, I'm almost ashamed.
It's not our aim to make people ashamed.
I understand.
The aim is to make them realize their responsibilities to the Lord.
Yes,
we call ourselves consecrated.
Yes.
Consecration means dedication. And I can show you people in the world that are dedicated to causes. They work their heads off and eventually die from drink because of their disappointment, of their frustration.
You made your point, Brother Peter, because the point about the conscientious objectors, and the point is, I was thinking, we're in the Lord's army, and if you join the army in the world, you usually serve a hitch of 2 or 3 years, and we ought to be willing to do that for the Lord. I see your point. I'm sure the younger brethren will catch it. Now.
I have a question here that some of the young people often ask after I've taken some groups out co-porting, as tracting. They sometimes say that the people ask them, are you a Jehovah Witness? Are you a Russellite? And even one came back and asked, who is Judge Rutherford? Somebody asked me about Judge Rutherford, never heard of him. What kind of answers would these young people offer that would satisfy the questioner? Are you a Jehovah Witness or are you a Russellite?
Well, that, of course, depends on the circumstances and your own experiences and probably contact with them. To me, if a person asked me if I'm Jehovah's Witness, I would say yes. I am Jehovah's Witness, but I don't belong to the group that called themselves Jehovah's Witnesses.
Very good.
Every Christian ought to be a witness for Jehovah. There is no restriction. I don't like to use the name. Our Jewish brethren, after they wrote the name Jehovah with a pen, destroyed the pen. They held the name so important and so high that they don't use it. They say, the Lord, blessed be his name. They never mention Jehovah. And if, of course, it was an unpronounceable name anyhow. In fact, I lived long enough to read an advertisement in the paper of a jazz band. They were advertised, their name was the Jehovah's of Jazz. That's how cheap our friends have made the name Jehovah.
Brother Peter, that one other point. That point you brought out about we are the true witnesses for Jehovah. But I often hear, and even the brethren, and it used to be that I did it myself, I don't like, because of the respect and the that you put on the name Jehovah Witness, JWs. I think it's
abbreviation.
Yes, a bad thing to get into the habit of using. And I would urge, would you urge the young, I think the young people should handle themselves with decorum and so forth. Now, the word of encouragement to the young brethren who go out then and meet with these this resistance by the people where they're tracking, would you suggest that if they realize that they can do anything in Christ along these lines, wouldn't that be the admonition?
The advice is to develop some way of overcoming that resistance. That is the resistance to the name or the charge that we are Jehovah's Witnesses. If the challenge, my challenge would be, get Jehovah's Witnesses here and they'll tell you who I am. In fact, we are the worst enemies Jehovah's Witnesses have. We are the most objectionable people in the world to Jehovah's Witnesses. In fact, they have more in common with you as a Methodist or Baptist or Presbyterian than they have with me. That's how close I am to Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yes, I see. Now, let me ask you this. Get on the matter of consecration for the young people. You know, some young people, some are born into the truth. And some come in, with their parents who have consecrated, who weren't of a truth background, and their children, and they're all contemplating consecration. What would be your advice along these lines? Would you urge consecration?
I would never discourage anyone from dedicating his life to the Lord, even though the only effect it would have is to teach them the truth and to have them go to meetings. But that's not full consecration. Full consecration is to find out what the Lord is doing today and cooperate. What does the Lord want us to do today and take an active part in doing it?
Would you say that our seminars, our group meetings of young people are doing that, helping to do that?
I'm sorry to say, I was never invited, neither did I ever attend the seminar. I don't know what they're doing.
Brother Peter.
Now, but if they hold a seminar, and part of that time of the seminar is used to calling on people, and using, a boy asked me, I was saying in the convention, a boy was telling me, oh, I wish this convention would be a week long. And they got the conventions. They got, and I told the boy, I told the brother, I says, you were to one convention, you went to another, you came to this, and you're looking for another. I says, all you do at the convention is listen to what they're telling you. What's the matter with you telling somebody else about it? What's the matter with using your own words? Your own voice. Didn't the Lord tell us just that? Yeah. I will put my words in your mouth. Not on record, not on tape, not on anything. I'll put the word, my words in your mouth. You speak for me.
Well, that's beautiful, Brother Peter. In closing now...
To encourage the friends is to discharge their obligations to the Lord. There are rewards. I wish we had time to tell you some of my experiences.
You're out of time, Brother.
It's all gone now.
It's all gone.
Yeah.
Remember, you told me I couldn't... Wait a minute, Brother Peter. We got a couple more minutes. I just wanted to ask you in closing. I knew that an hour with Peter Coleman wouldn't be enough, brethren. But anyway, Brother Peter, please relate the humorous incident that you had on a witnessing effort when someone came to your door. I think it was a Jehovah Witness.
I didn't. I remember the experience. It wasn't a matter of they coming to my door.
Oh, I thought they...
Brother Elias Mundell, by the way, one of our most successful court workers,
yes,
of recent times, he sold the Divine Plan of the Ages to a lady. And like we liked to do it, after a few weeks, I called back on the lady. I said, why did you buy the book? Also, because it's so much like what we believe. I says, what are you? She says, I'm Jehovah's Witness. I says, you are Jehovah's Witness. Don't you know, I said, that the Watchtower Bible Society published this book? No, she said. I says, yes, it did. Who wrote it? I says, Brother Russell wrote it. Is this Brother Russell's book? Yes, it's Brother Russell's book. Open the fly leaf and read. She read it. Then she was surprised. I said, now you tell me you're Jehovah's Witness. What are your hopes? Oh, I'm going to live on the earth, beautiful earth. I said, what were you before you joined the Witnesses? She says, I was a Baptist. I says, and what were your hopes when you were a Baptist? She said, go to heaven, of course. I says, then you swap, you're going to heaven in exchange for a life on the earth? She says, I never thought of it that way.
Well, brother, and that...
She came in the truth finally. She immersed. Right now, by the way, she is in a hospital, and every assault in the drop in this year.
Well, brother, and that brings our interview with Brother Peter Coleman to a close. It certainly wasn't enough time by a long shot to get all of his experiences and thoughts on tape. But I would just like to say in closing to the young brethren who might hear this tape at a seminar or a study.
Is it going? I was some time back, I was trying to remember a name. I just now remembered it. Becky Hack is the name.
Oh, yes.
Good, thank you.
So, brethren, if you can get any encouragement from Brother Peter's zeal, from the first time I've known him, the zeal has never lessened. It's grown stronger and stronger. And I think that if Brother Peter gets a chance, that at some seminar in the near future, he could put forth some of these views to the young people and encourage them and instruct them along the lines of full portraying, because I too happen to feel that the personal contact by the mouth is much better than the written word. And we thank you, Brother Peter, and I'm sure Brother Malinowski will turn it over to him to close the interview.
Yes, and I want to thank you on behalf of those who will be listening, the young people particularly, because they are hungry for a little bit of the background. They'll give them answers to questions that they're asked by people to whom they witness. I would like to ask Brother Coleman if he would close our little informal gathering here with the Lord's blessing upon it.
Eternal God, our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity of speaking to our children, your children, our brethren, and indicating to them the way, our way, the way that thou hast led us, the way thou hast blessed our lives, the way that made our lives happy, joyous, and rewarding. We thank thee for the opportunities. Continue to use us until we breathe the last breath. In Jesus' name.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Peter.